really lead our life. At least every intelligent man could understand that this complex living of today is making our life so miserable. And most of the people today, most of the intelligent people today are considering how to simplify their life. All over the world today, there are many, many movements, those who are trying to aspire to simplify their lives in different ways. And so tonight, I'll throw some light on this simple living aspect from our Vedic paradigm or Vedic perspective. As a matter of fact, just simple living itself is not enough. Along with simple living, a human being should also have the high thinking aspect of it as well. Because just simple living does not satisfy the human cravings. The animals in the forest are also living a rather simple life, apparently simple life, but obviously we do not want to become like animals. Although we are aspiring for simple life, a natural life, but that should be supported by high thinking as well. Otherwise, human beings are not going to be satisfied. Now, that is the Vedic consideration. Vedic understanding was not simply to be satisfied with simple living, but at the same time they aspired for high thinking, and not only the high thinking, they aspired for the highest thinking. And the approach was made in a way which was supported with all different branches of philosophies. Actually, all the Vedic branches of philosophies are ultimately leading to the point of the highest thinking, the highest realization. And they have analyzed that the human life is actually meant for that highest thinking. Human life is not meant for just eating and sleeping and mating and defending. These four aspects of life are considered to be animalistic. The animal life is motivated by these four criterions, like eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. But human life is actually meant for transcending these four animalistic propensities. And in order to approach the ultimate goal of human life, the Vedic philosophy or Vedic wisdom defined that the human identity or our identity has three aspects. And those three aspects of our identities are physical, mental, and spiritual. At the basic platform, we all think that our body is the self. I am this body. But a little bit of intelligent approach to that understanding reveals the fact that we are not this body, but actually we are something beyond this body. The intelligence, human intelligence, actually begins with that understanding. Now, first question is, who am I? And the analyzing that question, one comes to realize that although it appears that he himself is the body, but actually his identity is not this body, but beyond this body. So when one comes to that understanding, then he transcends the bodily platform and comes to the intellectual platform. When one analyzes, then he sees that his body is not the self, but beyond the body he has his mind. And the mind is not solely dependent on the body. Mind can function without the body. For instance, when the body is inactive, when we are dreaming, when we are sleeping, The body is totally inactive. We do not have any awareness of the body as such. But still we dream. Now dream does not take place on the gross physical or bodily platform. The dream takes place on the mental platform. So that is the second aspect, that we have another aspect of our identity, that is our intellect or our mind. And analyzing further, one comes to realize that he is not even his mind. His actual identity is beyond his mind or beyond his intelligence. That is, his real identity is spiritual. So this is how the Vedas or Vedic wisdom analyze these three aspects of our identity, namely physical, mental and spiritual. Now automatically one will question that how can you so firmly or how can you so positively affirm that our bodily identity is not our real identity. After all, everybody thinks that he is his body, and as long as we have this body, we are here, we are alive, but the moment we leave the body, we are dead and we are gone. Fine, that's a nice question. But the approach is, like you consider who you actually are and what your body actually is. Now when we consider that, then we can see that this body is not a constant factor, but it's a changing factor. First of all, this body is a lump of matter. Body is made of matter. But when we analyze the nature around us, the material nature around us, then we notice that matter as such is inert. Matter doesn't have consciousness. Take a piece of stone, take a log of wood, take anything that is matter as such from the nature. Does it have consciousness? No, matter in itself doesn't have consciousness or awareness of its identity. But this body, although it is made of matter, it is matter, but this body has consciousness. Your body has consciousness. Even the animals, the birds, the insects, the worms, even the trees have consciousness. Now, although they have a body made of matter, but they are actually conscious beings. Now, how does that consciousness come into matter? That has been analyzed, that this consciousness comes from the spirit. For instance, as long as your spirit, your soul, is in your body is conscious, your body is alive. But the moment the spirit leaves the body becomes dead. The body becomes matter again. The unconscious, temporary, transient matter that the body is, it becomes that as soon as the spirit leaves the body. For instance, when now that I'm talking to you, you all are considering that he is talking to us, he is here, and so on and so forth. But if I drop dead now, if I just die now, my body will be lying here, but you will say that he is gone. Now, if I was my body, then the body is lying here. Why do you say that he is gone? Now, who is he? At least we can understand that he is he who kept this body alive. So, that is the spirit. And the Vedic wisdom analyzes through these branches of philosophy. Actually, I am repeatedly making this point that these are all philosophical conclusions from the Vedas. Firstly, because I do not have enough time to consider all these different branches of philosophy, but I want to affirm this point that none of these are actually mental concoction or just imaginary conclusions. All these conclusions are based with sound philosophical understanding or sound scientific verification. Actually, here's the difference between Vedic philosophy and modern philosophy. The modern philosophy is some assumption out of some speculation. A thoughtful person, a thinker, he thinks with his elevated mind and intelligence, and then he just makes some conclusions, and that becomes his philosophy. But that is not the case with the Vedic philosophy. The Vedic philosophy is actually to support the ultimate fact. The Vedic philosophy is not approaching the absolute truth, but it is a derivative of the absolute truth, and the philosophy is not actually concluding the absolute truth, but the philosophy is supporting the absolute truth. So, for instance, to give an example how that is, like the sun comes in the sky. Now, it is a fact that the sun comes up in the sky, right? If you agree with that or you do not agree with that, still the sun will come up in the sky every day, right? But that is a fact. But in order to make that conclusion that the sun comes up in the sky, eastern horizon every morning and sets in the western horizon every evening, you can make so many different derivatives or so many factors to establish that fact. Like, you can say that the sun comes up, that's why the whole world becomes illuminated. The whole darkness is removed because the sun's rays. And the plants and animals, they survive, they derive their life energy from the sun. So this way, there are various ways you can justify the fact that the sun comes up every morning and sets in every evening. Like, one verification is that when the sun comes up, everything becomes light. And when the sun disappears, then everything becomes dark. So that, in a way, proves that the sun comes up every day and sets at night, disappears at night, so and so forth. So the Vedic philosophy is not actually deriving the absolute truth by the philosophical speculation, but the absolute truth is there, and the philosophical understanding is just making the approach to verify that truth. Anyway, so now, this is one way that Vedas derive that our body is not our actual self. Our actual self is the spirit. Now, we can at least intellectually apprehend it, that when the spirit leaves the body becomes dead. And as long as the spirit remains in the body remains alive. Now, the spirit is our actual identity, and the body is a foreign burden to the spirit. Now, spirit is coming from the spiritual nature, but the spirit has come into the material nature, and in the material nature, the spirit has developed a material body, and the spirit is identifying himself with this material body. And it is actually causing him a lot of inconveniences. The body is a cumbersome burden to the spirit. Like we can see, it is such an endeavor to keep this body alive. In order to keep this body alive, we have to take breath. We have to drink. We have to eat. and then we have to protect it from external calamities. And then on top of that, the body has so many demands, and we have to fulfill those demands. Now, you can see that in order to maintain the body, it becomes such an endeavor. Like, can you imagine if you didn't have the body, how simpler the life would have been? Actually, the Buddhist philosophy make the approach from that angle of vision, that point of philosophy, that the Buddhist philosophy concludes that all the pain, all the suffering is caused by this body. So just get rid of the body. But the Vedic philosophy did not accept that, because the Vedic understanding is the body may be the cause of suffering, but that doesn't mean that we should get rid of the body. Like, for instance, you may have some wound in your leg, but that doesn't mean that you should chop off the leg. Of course, you have the leg and that's why you have the wound in the leg. But cutting the leg off is not the solution. If you have an wound, then heal the wound. So the body is causing us a lot of inconveniences, lot of troubles. So let us consider how we can get rid of this trouble. We should not say that let us get rid of this body. And with that understanding, the Vedas are approaching, making the second conclusion, that higher than the body, say the body is involved in the material platform, and that's why the body is going through so many cumbersome experiences. Now, in order to withdraw ourselves, in order to get rid of those miserable factors in our existence, we have to be rid of our body's involvement in the material nature. So the first aspect is that let us minimize the demands of the body as much as we can. And that is done by the intellectual understanding. Now, do I really need to eat so much? To give an example, we like to eat. The body loves to eat. Right? And actually body needs the food. And since we have our palate, our tongue, and we enjoy eating. Now, we love to eat, but when you overeat, then we suffer. Right? So then an intelligent man would think that each time I eat more than I need, I just end up suffering in the morning. So let me not eat too much. Let me eat only as much as I need. Now, this conclusion on this kind of training can be attained by our intellectual or mental analysis or mental understanding, intellectual understanding. Like, with our intelligence, we can reason. And by reasoning, we restrain from unnecessary involvement. Like, for instance, often you think this is a nice apartment, but it's costing me so much. So do I really need such a big apartment? So maybe I'll be quite all right with a rather smaller apartment that will have less rent and so on and so forth. So this is only an intelligent man can conclude like that. So this is how, by intelligence, we minimize our body's needs. And the most intelligent person will try to minimize his body's needs to the greatest extent. So this is how, when we are in the bodily platform, then we try to enjoy and enjoy with the body. But when we transcend the bodily platform and come to the intellectual platform, then you try to minimize the body's needs. And at that point, the ultimate point of this intellectual platform in the Vedic understanding is called yoga. And the yoga's business is to withdraw oneself from the material involvement. Like, this different aspects of our identity has been covered by different branches of Vedic philosophy. Or first, there are three different sections. Like, first section of the Vedic wisdom is called activities, karma khanda. Karma means activity, khanda means section. The section that deals with activities, how one should act. Then the second stage is called jnana khanda. Second section is called jnana khanda, or the section that deals with knowledge. And the third section is called upasana khanda, or the section that deals with worshipping the Lord. So this is how the Vedic philosophy, Vedic wisdom has been defined in three different sections, and they have been covered by different branches of philosophy. They are the six main branches of philosophy. So the karma khanda, or the activity section, is covered by a branch of philosophy called Purva Mimamsa, or preliminary conclusion. Then the second branch, second section, intellectual section, is defined by four different branches of philosophies known as Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Shankha, and Yoga. And then the third branch, third section, is covered by one branch of philosophy known as Uttar Mimamsa, or final conclusion. So this is how different branches of philosophy have covered these different aspects of wisdom. Now, when one comes to the intellectual platform, transcending the bodily platform, then final stage he attains is called yoga. And the yoga is the process of linking up with the Lord. And before they enter into the process of linking up, the main aspect is to withdraw oneself from all material involvement. In order to practice yoga, one has to withdraw himself from all material involvement. The way the yogas are being taught in the West nowadays, it's a totally useless application of the Vedas. And in plain and simple word, we can say that it's just a simple process of cheating. There are some people are coming from India and claiming that he's a yogi, and he's telling people that you come, give me some money and I'll teach you yoga. And right in the middle of Swiss city, he rents an apartment. And in that apartment, every day for 15 minutes or half an hour or 1 hour, he teaches them yoga. That is just a plain and simple way of cheating people. The first criterion for yoga is to go away from human habitation. One must go away into a solitary place. And in the solitary place, he must learn how to curtail his demands of the body. The first thing is called external purification, then internal purification, then using the body as a vehicle to reach the ultimate goal. Then the fourth is to control the breathing, and then ultimately one stops breathing altogether. And then when one stops breathing, then he practices to withdraw his senses from the objects of the senses. And then begins meditation. The meditation begins after one has completely withdrawn his senses from the objects of his senses. Like at that stage, the form may be there in front of his eyes, but he won't register the form. The sound may be there next to his ears, but he won't register the sound. So this way he withdraws himself completely from the objects of the senses. That means when one is completely withdrawn from external involvement, then only he can project himself internally, the innermost core of his heart. And that innermost core of his heart, in the innermost core of his heart, he perceives the Lord. So that is the goal of meditation. So we can see that, so the second stage, the stage of intellectual stage, is not an easy thing. Like to withdraw oneself from material involvement is not very easy. So the first stage is causing us some problem, that involvement in the material platform. Then when we realize that these involvements are the cause of our suffering, then we withdraw ourselves from the involvement by means of intellect. But withdrawing is difficult, because can you imagine living isolated all by yourself in a solitary place where there is no one, where you don't have any shelter, where there is no grocery store to buy your things, and no autobahn to drive your cars, and so forth. It's a difficult job to live where you are trying or practicing to withdraw yourself from material involvement. But then the third stage, the spiritual stage, is the most simple stage, because at the ultimate stage of your intellectual development, you recognize yourself as the spirit, and you recognize yourself as a part and parcel of the Supreme Spirit, God. So the third stage, that is spiritual stage, is the endeavor to become connected to the Lord. Like, when you understand that we are the part and parcels of the Lord, then it is the duty, or it's the business of the part, to be connected to the whole. Now, as a part, we all are parts and parcels of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, how we can become connected to Him? So that means of connection has been defined as love. Because love is the factor that brings us close together. Love brings together, and hatred separates each other. Now, if we want to go close to the Lord, then the means to approach Him, the means to come close to Him is love. So in the Upasana Kanda, or in the third stage, the spiritual stage, it has been pointed out that one must learn, or one must practice to love the Lord. And when we begin to love the Lord, then our relationship with Him is established, and then we realize that He is our supreme benefactor. He is our supreme father, He is our supreme friend, He is our supreme lover. And when we have that realization, then our life automatically becomes very simple, because the Lord is omnipotent, He is the supreme proprietor, and He is the supreme controller. So when we accept Him as our supreme master or supreme protector, then automatically we feel very happy, we feel very relaxed. We become free from anxiety. It is like when a child is holding his father's hand, he doesn't have any anxiety. Or when the son is related to the father, dependent on the father, and automatically the son feels relaxed. And what to talk about if you have a father who is the richest person? Now, we all have a father who is the richest person. That is God. God, who is the supreme proprietor, the supreme controller, He is our father. And if we have that realization, will we have any anxiety? Like, we notice that how carefree a rich man's son feels. If you have a rich father, then how do you feel? Or, say for instance, if you have somebody who is very rich and gives you the assurance that you are going to be protected by him, he'll take care of you in every respect. How will you feel? Automatically your life will become free from all anxiety. And that is what happens when you take to spiritual life. And in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives that assurance. There Krishna says, revealing his identity, he says, bhoktaram yogya tapasam sarva loko maheshwaram shurhidam sarva-bhutanam jatvamam shantim-richati. He says that I am the supreme enjoyer. The Lord is announcing that He is the supreme enjoyer. And then immediately after that He says that He is the supreme proprietor. Now you can enjoy something that belongs to you. If something doesn't belong to you and you try to enjoy it, will it be justified? No. If you do that, then people will call you a thief. If something belongs to somebody else and you try to enjoy it, then you end up becoming a thief. So, the justified enjoyment is when you are the proprietor of those objects of enjoyment. Now the Lord is the supreme enjoyer because He is the supreme proprietor. Now here I'll make one point also, is that when you talk about God, when I'm talking about God, or when I mention God, I'm not talking about Hindu God or Christian God or Jewish God or so and so forth. I'm talking about that one and only one supreme personality of Godhead. It is not that Christians have one God and Hindus have another God and Jews have another God and so on and so forth. God is one and only one without a second. That is the definition of God. And as a matter of fact, all the religions are approaching Him. All the religions are trying to approach that one and only one supreme personality of Godhead. But unfortunately, misinterpretation by less intelligent and less realized people, the religions are becoming narrow-minded, superstitious concepts, and they're deviating from the essence of the religion, that is to approach God. Like if all the religions follow this principle of approaching the Lord, then I'm sure that there won't be any differences between different religions. All the religions will join hands together and move on forward happily ever after. So here in Bhagavad Gita, the Lord gave the instruction that He is the supreme enjoyer and He is the supreme proprietor. And He is the dearmost friend of every living entity. The Lord is everyone's dearmost friend. He's such a close friend. He's so concerned about us that He is accompanying us, every one of us, all the time. He is sitting in everybody's heart. Although we have rejected Him, He is going with us wherever we are going. It is not that the Lord is sitting in only in human hearts, not in the other species of life. No, the Lord is sitting in the heart of every living entity. He is situated in the hearts of the human beings. He is situated in the heart of the animals. He is situated in the heart of the birds and insects and even the trees and plants. Because wherever there is life, there is spirit soul. And wherever there is a spirit soul, the Lord is there in the heart. Now, He is so concerned about us and He is actually providing us with all that we need. Now, we simply have to realize that He does take care of us. And then only we become free from all our anxieties. As I was giving the example of a child and the father, like when the child is isolated from his father, say for instance, I don't know whether you ever had that experience, but I'm sure you can well imagine. Say for instance, you are a child and you went out for a walk with your father. Say you went to a big fair with your father. Then all of a sudden you realize that you lost your father. Then how would you feel? How does a child who is lost, feel? He begins to cry. At least, actually, I remember it very well because once I got lost. And my immediate reaction was I began to cry. But then when I got back my father again, then all my anxieties were over. So that is the thing, like every one of us have actually lost our father. And independently we are trying to make so many endeavors. We are always struggling to survive. And we are in so much anxiety. We are trying to make money. No matter how much money you have, you still want to put more money in the bank. No matter how much securities you have, still you are not satisfied. You want more and more and more. Why? Because you are in anxiety. Because of this uncertainty, you are trying to make a nice arrangement in the material platform. But in spite of all these arrangements, can you become free from anxiety? Like if I ask you, is there anyone who is completely free from anxiety here? Please raise your hand. Yes? Okay. So now the scripture says that only two kinds of people think that they are completely free from anxiety. One who is an absolute wisdom, and the other who is an absolute fool. So you must be one of them, either of these two. So, but the thing is, at least you can see, we can see that in this hall, auditorium where there are about a hundred people, there's only one hand raised. That means the rest of them are not quite free from anxiety. Now, why is that? Like, you do not really have to be in such anxiety because you have secured your life so much. You have a place to live, you have sufficient bank balance, you have sufficient securities and so on and so forth. But still, why you are not free from anxiety? And it is natural because although we are making all these arrangements, all our arrangements fall short. Like, you may be free from anxiety, but when you are crossing the road, then all of a sudden a car comes and bangs you. Right? And, you are very nicely situated in your nice apartment, then all of a sudden there's an earthquake, and the whole thing just falls apart. Right? So you can conceive that there are so many different ways that you may suffer, and that's why you are in constant anxiety. And what to talk about other things, like I was saying, that all over Switzerland there is big posters, especially in the big cities of Switzerland, stop aid. So everybody must be in anxiety, right? Whenever something happens, you wonder, did I get it? or if you get a little lump in your body and you wonder, is this cancer? Right? And so all the time you are in constant anxiety. So, an intelligent man is in anxiety unless and until he has become totally free from all material involvement. As long as you are involved in the material nature, you cannot become free from anxiety. And if you don't have that kind of anxiety, you have other anxiety, whether your son is going to become a waster, or whether your daughter is going to run away with somebody else, and so on and so forth. So, everybody is in constant anxiety. But when we hold on to the hands of the Lord, when we just surrender to the Lord, who is the supreme controller, then we become free from anxiety. Then you realize that now at least I don't have to worry about myself anymore. The one who is controlling everything, he is going to take care of me. My father is the supreme controller. So understanding that, one becomes free from anxiety. So the Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Gyatva mam shanti mrichati. When one understands me this way, that I am the supreme proprietor, I am the supreme enjoyer, and I am the dearmost friend of every living entity. So, simple living ultimately culminates into spiritual life, and I can say that the simplest possible living is actually available only in the spiritual platform. And that platform is the highest platform that one can be, and that life is full of joy, full of bliss. Thank you very much, Hare Krishna. If anyone has any question, you can ask. Yes? Yeah, well, what's so difficult about it? Just open your eyes and look at it. That's the first proof. What is the proof then? The thing is that, yeah, the proof is, you know, like proof is by our verified knowledge, right? When I see the sun, what more proof do you need? Well, first of all, you have to understand that this is what I'm giving an example. And it's not a very, very, you know, like, why should I think that I'm seeing the sun? I'm jolly well seeing the sun. And not only I, you, him, anybody who has eyes can see that the sun is up there in the sky. So what is there to think about? You think that you cannot see. Right? But when you see something, that is a verified thought. Right? That is reality. I mean, what better proof there can be than your eyes, than your seeing? Right? I mean, what is the best proof that you can think of? Right? The best proof is seeing. Right? So when you see that the sun comes up in the sky, then why should you think that maybe you are thinking that the sun is up in the sky, but actually the sun is not in the sky. Well, that I pointed out, like, there are so many things you cannot see, but still you intelligently you conclude. Like, for instance, you do not see your mind also, but you know that you have your mind. Right? It is intellectual reasoning. Not that you have to see everything. Like, for instance, you didn't see your great-grandfather. Did you? You didn't. But you know that he was. Right? Or you'll say, yes. I mean, you'll shrug your shoulder as if your great-grandfather didn't exist. Yeah? I mean, any intelligent man will agree that he had a great-grandfather. Isn't it? So the thing is that there are some things that you may not see, but still you know that it was or it is. So the example I gave, like, what keeps the body alive? What makes the body alive? So you're living now, right? Now what makes your body alive? Anyway, most of the cells change, right? Okay. So fine. Most of the cells change. So the body is different. The body that you have today is... No, you are the same. Like when you think that when I was 5 years old, that I is still the same. And anyway, again, I'll appeal to you, please use your intelligence. Not just, you know, bluntly say, no, I don't agree with you. Like, because if you just don't want to, you know, if you don't want to at least reason it out, then it will be very difficult for me to make the point. Like, I am the same. Like, I am... Like, when you think, when you are 5 years old, is that a different person altogether? It's the same you. Maybe your intelligence develops a little more, right? No, you're, as I said, that you are not... You didn't change. You are the same person. Right? Like, say, for instance, whoever you are, was it a different person when you were 5 years old? Was it a different person? Was it somebody else? Say, what is your name? Say, what is your name? Ivan. So now you're Ivan, and when you're 5 years old, were you, say, Tom?
fine, but I'm saying the identity. I mean, say Tom is a person and Ivan is a person. So when you're 5 years old, were you Ivan the person or Tom the person? Yeah, but and you are the same person also. Okay, so you may be different. Everybody else is different. Everybody else remains the same. Yeah. Well, it was just, you have to understand that I was just citing some examples. Generally, people think, right? Generally, it is you can see that generally people think that less involved they get in the material dealing, is easier their life becomes. To give an example, the French kings in early days, they used to leave their palace and go to the village and live like a villager. I'm sure you're familiar with that idea. Okay, that's the lack of your knowledge in history. So, the thing is that anybody in his right sense of mind will understand that actually material involvement causes us trouble. The more you get involved in material dealing, more you collect matter, right? The more complex your life becomes. So since our topic of discussion was simple living and high thinking, so I just made that point. And ultimate thing is, isn't it simpler just to depend on somebody? If you can depend on somebody, doesn't it make your life a lot easier? No? Yes. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, fine. So you actually asked three different questions, right? Three phases. So the first one is, I would say, that the first one leads us to the conclusion that ignorance is bliss, right? But ignorance may be bliss for a less developed person, but ignorance is not bliss for a thoroughly intelligent person, right? First thing. Second thing is that, you see, I was just given, say, analogy. An analogy is given with a perfect assumption, like assuming that that it is a perfect condition. Like, when I give the example of a son holding the hand of a father, I'm not considering that the father is a lunatic or the father is a maniac or so and so forth, then automatically it's dangerous, you know. Like, I mean, to hold a hand of that kind of a person is dangerous. But generally, the concept that we have of a father, right, as a child, when he holds the hand of a father, he automatically feels relaxed. I'm talking about a normal father, who has his due affection for his children, who is not a loony, right, who has enough security for himself and so on and so forth. And then on top of that, when I said God, when I'm giving the example of holding the hand of the Father, I'm just pointing out to holding the hand of the God, holding the hand of God, who is perfect, right? And as I said also, that He is the supreme controller and He is the supreme proprietor and He is the supreme Father. Now, if you are holding the hand of someone who is the supreme proprietor and the supreme Father, then it is natural that you will feel completely relaxed, right? As a matter of fact, that's the first feeling I got when I decided to take to this life, when I had that realization that the God is the supreme controller and I have a relationship with Him, and this life is actually meant for developing that relationship. The first feeling I had, from now on, I won't have to worry about anything myself. Now the third question, as you said, that the jumping into the conclusion, I actually wanted to cut it short because you see, like, it's such a vast subject, and if you go really, as I, in the beginning I mentioned that if you go step by step, then it becomes a very, very elaborate discussion, and it's not practically possible to give the whole wisdom in just 1 hour's time. So the Vedic philosophy makes the approach there is a branch of philosophy called Shankha, or the analytical study, right? So when they analyze the material nature, the first analysis they make is that the material nature is composed of five elements, like earth, water, fire, air, and ether. Then they analyze that we have five senses: the eyes, the ears, the nose, the touch, and tongue. And the interaction between these five elements and our senses gives rise to five sense objects. Like ether interacts with ears, sound is produced. Air interacts with skin, the touch is produced. Fire interacts with eyes, form is produced. Water interacts with tongue, the taste is produced. And earth interacts with nose and smell is produced. So five objects of the senses are produced out of the interaction between the elements and the senses. Then there are five sense objects. They are arms, the legs, the belly, the anus, and genitals. And so five poles are 20. Then they consider three subtle elements like mind, intelligence, and placebo. And then the 24th consideration is the basic ingredient of material creation known as Mahatattva. So with this 24 consideration, they analyze the whole material creation. But then they conclude that all these 24 considerations are objective in nature. But objects cannot exist without the subject. Now what is the subject? The subject is I. I am, that's why this nature is manifest. When I am not, this nature will not be manifest to me. So everybody has his I, and that I is the subject, which is actually supporting these objects. But, so the I, or the spirit, soul, or Atma in Sanskrit, is the 25th consideration. Now, with this 24th consideration, they have analyzed the whole creation, material creation. But they couldn't find the I in this 24 analysis. So hence the conclusion is, the I is not material. I is non-material. I is spiritual. Then they consider that there are many I's and they're minute. There are many, the I's are many and minute. Like I have my I, you have your I, he has his eye, and so all there are many eyes and they are minute. Now anything that is many and minute has to have an origin, right? Like the raindrops are falling. Now the drops are minute and they are many, so it must have an origin. The origin is the reservoir, the ocean. So the same way, all these eyes, all these spirit souls, the minute and many individual spirit souls, originated from the Supreme Spirit. So the 26th consideration is the Supreme Spirit or Super Soul or God. So this is how, by philosophical approach, they establish the fact of God or existence of God. Very good, yeah, right. So that's actually a very good point, because the Vedas also define God as adhokshaja, or beyond our sense perception, right? See, our material senses are good for just receiving material experiences. With our eyes we can only see material objects. With our eyes we can hear only the material sounds, right? So these senses are limited only to the material perception. But God is beyond matter, right? He is spiritual, so He is beyond our sense perception. But He exists. Now, we cannot say that since I do not see Him, He doesn't exist, right? We cannot say that won't be a very intelligent conclusion. There are so many things that we do not see, but still they exist. So we cannot limit the absolute by our limited perception, right? So when He exists, then, you know, like at least one thing has been affirmed that said, in order to approach this point, I'll also make another analogy, or it's actually a real example. You see, Sir Isaac Newton was a theist. He used to believe in God. But he had a friend, a philosopher, who was atheist, who was an atheist. And they used to have arguments often. And Newton could not make him agree that God exists. So one day, he came to Newton's laboratory and he saw a model of the solar system. The sun in the middle and different planets are moving in different velocity around the sun, by the arrangements of spheres and levers. So he was amazed, and his immediate reaction was, "Oh, Newton, who made this?" So Newton's reply was, "No one made this." So he said, "Come on, tell me who made this. You must have made it." So he says, no one made it. It just happened by accident." And so the friend kept on insisting, "Please tell me who made this." So finally Newton says, that look, when I point out to this model and tell you that no one makes it, you don't believe me. But when I point out to the night sky and show you these innumerable stars and planets maintaining this enormous order, and I tell you there must be a creator and a maintainer behind that, then you don't believe that. So you see, this way, by expanding our intelligence a little further, we can at least understand the existence of God. Now the question comes whether God is just an energy or God is a person, right? Now, the thing is that, you see, whenever there is some control, there must be some intelligence, right? And intelligence is a personal feature. Intelligence is not an impersonal feature, right? And if you like, and another thing is that since it is beyond our sense perception, by depending on our senses, we cannot actually reach that region, right? I mean, we'll just keep on arguing till the doomsday, right, without coming to any conclusion. But the thing is, if we make an approach in a proper way, like at least if we submit to the scriptures that have been approved by the very, very elevated personality, then the understanding becomes a lot easier. Like, to give one example, like, Bible says, the man has been created according to the image of God. So, doesn't that imply that God, the man's form, actually is the image of God's form? The God has a form which looks very much like man. But the difference is, our form is made of matter. This form, this body is made of matter, whereas God's body is spiritual. It is spirit. And if you want to go further, then I can make another approach. You see, in the Vedic philosophy, there are two branches also, personal and impersonal, right? So, the impersonal aspect you understand, that is, they do not accept God as a person, but they accept God as energy. So, in that aspect, the personal aspect makes an approach that they defeat their point that God is impersonal. They defeat that argument by 21 different reasoning or 21 different points. Now, few very interesting ones, like one I'll mention here. Because the others are just, you know, like, unless you are very well aware of the philosophy, it may not make so much sense. But this one point makes a lot of sense, that is, if we accept God, then we have to accept that God is greater than us, right? So, God, greater means He has everything that we have, plus He has something that we do not have, right? Like, say for instance, greater means, you know, like He has everything that we have, plus He has something that we do not have. Now, if we say that we have form, but God doesn't have form, then we are actually saying that God is something inferior to us. No, but the thing is, you see, the Lord is the controller of both matter as well as spirit. If He is the supreme controller, He is the controller of both matter and the spirit. He may not have the need, but He has the control over it. Like for instance, the king doesn't have the need of the prison, but still the king is the controller of the prison. Right? So the Lord may not have any need of this material nature, but still He is the controller of the material nature. And that is the criterion of supreme control. And another aspect, maybe this will also make some sense to you all. You see, the impersonalists give an example of how this material nature is unreal, right? And they give an example of illusion, right? And giving an illusion, they give to confirm that aspect of illusion, they give an example that the way we make mistakenly think a rope lying in darkness to be a snake. You see, when you see a rope, then you mistake the rope to be a snake, right? The same way, this material nature is illusory. It appears to be like this, but it is not actually this. And there are enough reasons also to come to that conclusion, because if we scientifically analyzed, then you can see that it's everything that you're perceiving is just a relative experience, right? Like, ultimately everything can be broken down into atomic theory, right? And then we'll see that everything is just atoms moving in different velocities, right? And different velocities, different frequencies are giving different sense perceptions. Ultimately it will come to that. So, it is true, huh? So that way, it is, in that way, this material nature is illusory. But the personalists, they defeat that point by saying that there may not be a snake in the rope, but somewhere the snake exists, that's why you mistake the rope to be a snake. Right? So we are mistakenly considering this nature to be real, but somewhere the reality is there, the real reality is there, that's why you're mistaking this to be reality. So that reality is the spiritual nature, and the spiritual, all the variegatedness that is existing in the material nature is existing in the spiritual nature as well. So the forms that are here, those forms are there also. Like for another example has been given, you see, this material nature is a reflection of the spiritual nature, right? Now whatever is existing in the reflection must be existing in the reality. Say for instance, you are seeing the reflection of a tree, right? In the reflection you are seeing some red flowers, some green leaves, and some brown branches. So it is understood that in the real tree there must be some branches, some leaves, some flowers, so on and so forth. If they were not there in the real, they couldn't have existed in the reflection.
Yes. Nihilism. You said that you read a point. They are qualitatively it's the same, but quantitatively different. Welcome. Is there any other? Yes. Yes, to begin with, we worry about our spiritual life. You see, these things, as I was pointing out, is whatever is there in the material platform is there also in the spiritual platform, because material nature is a reflection. But there are, you see, the worries also exist in the spiritual nature, right? But the difference is that worry is not same as the worries in the material nature. For instance, in the spiritual nature, you see, in the material nature, worries causes distress. But in the spiritual nature, worries causes joy. To give an example, the closest example I can give is, you see, the mother is also worried about her son, right? But that worry is a product of her affection for her child, right? And that actually gives her pleasure. To worry about the mother derives a lot of pleasure by being worried about her child. So in the spiritual nature, in the spiritual platform, we do worry about different things, but it is spiritual. And if you ask me what's the difference between material and spiritual, the difference between material and spiritual is, the material nature is the nature where we put ourselves as the center. Every individual puts himself in the center, and that is material nature. But the nature where God is the center, that is spiritual nature. So one can be very much in this world, but if he is leading a life with God in the center, that becomes spiritual. Is it clear? Yes. Yes, sure.
No. Give me the chapter. Sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
The
go ahead.
Word of Krishna and the Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah.
So I ask, why is it given all these precious tools if it is not meant to be an element of what the Christians would call self-will or free will?
Yeah. No, we do not deny that. We do not deny deny that we have free will. As a matter of fact, our whole philosophy is based on that. You see, the karmic theory is based on the will or independence. You see, you are independent and you are free to act as you want. But if your action leads you away from the Lord, you will become miserable. But if you come close to the Lord, then she will become joyful. Well, there may be different roads, one by the mountain, one by the river, and one by the autobahn. But what will an intelligent man take? An intelligent man will take the simplest one, right? Easiest one, right? And so, you see, there are actually different approaches, but the best is to take the simplest possible one. That is surrender, right? You see, like, you can approach the Lord by means of yoga. You can approach the Lord by means of mental speculation, and so on and so forth. But the easiest one, the ultimate one, is just to be surrendered unto Him, accepting Him as He is, right? Yeah. Right. Yeah. Because you see, it's like if you try to figure out whether you do have a father, right? It's a, you know, it's a hell of a troublesome job. You know, like, you have to accept somebody's authority, right? Like, somebody has to tell you that, look, he is your father, because you by yourself cannot really figure out who is your father. But if your mother comes and tells you, look, this is your father, so you can immediately accept him, because, you know, who knows it better than your mother, right? And then, since he is your father, he has some natural affection for you, and you also have some natural love for him. And as soon as you come close to each other, then that, that act, you see, the affection and love, reciprocation is there. And then automatically, you see, the relationship develops. So same way, you see, like, the moment you begin to the moment you accept the Lord, then the Lord just doesn't sit there as an inert object. He reciprocates, and you feel it. Otherwise, to tell you frankly, otherwise I wouldn't have been here. if my conviction or my initial faith was not verified with due realization or reciprocation, I wouldn't have been a devotee of Krishna. But still today I am, and because it has been verified time and time again. I mean, although I started with certain amount of faith, and actually in order to start anything, you have to start with certain amount of faith. Like, so for instance, when you started even to learn A, B, C, D, like your mother said, this is A, this is B, and with your faith, you accepted, yes, this is A and this is B. So when you grew up and began to read big book, then it has been verified that yes, A is A and B is B. So the same way, although we begin our spiritual life with certain amount of faith, but as we keep practicing, then that faith becomes verified, and that's how the conviction becomes stronger and stronger. You're from the faith, right? What are you doing here? Oh, okay. Yes. Well, according to their intelligence, then the road may differ. But the most intelligent one will take the simplest one. Yes, yes. As I said, just to surrender to the Lord, like hold His hand and accept Him as your Supreme Father and Supreme Friend. So, yes. What in? Grace. Grace. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, it does. it does. Because ultimately, you see, ultimately it is the grace, by the grace of the Lord, that one can approach Him. Right? And but the thing is that the grace of the Lord is being showered upon everyone. Right? But if somebody is not willing to take it, then what can he do? I mean, see, the rains are pouring. But if we do not want to, you see, take the water and quench our thirst, I mean, who can we blame? Actually, as I said, you see, like, one of the qualities of the Lord is that He's all merciful. He is full of mercy, and He is always concerned about everyone. And He wants us to go back to Him. And it is said, if we take one step towards the Lord takes 100 steps to pick us up. Yeah, then we have to go back to his point, that do we have some independence? Yes, we have some independence. Actually, God has given us the independence. Now the question may arise, why did He give us independence? The answer is, you see, we have a loving relationship with Him. Our relationship with the Lord is of love. And love cannot be forced. Love is spontaneous. So the Lord has given us the independence so that we can voluntarily, spontaneously decide to love Him. And when you do that, then immediately you become connected to Him. But when you reject Him, then we fall down to this material condition. Actually, He doesn't want us to leave Him. Before we leave Him, He warns us, why are you leaving us? It's like, you know, the little child wants to put his hand in the fire. The father says, don't put your hand in the fire. But son begins to cry, says, no, I'll put my hand in the fire. Then the father finally says, okay, fine, go ahead and put your hand. And then as soon as he puts his hand, he gets hurt. And then he comes back to the father. So our condition is like that. We are a bunch of naughty children. Right? We don't want to listen to His good advice. Welcome. Yes. Yes, fine. So my answer to that question is, whatever it is, at least try to approach to the Lord. Go by boat, go by aeroplane, go by car, doesn't matter. But at least try to approach Him. It's instead of just, going into some, intellectual, acrobatics, let's just try to come to the brass tacks, that let's just surrender to the Lord. Never said that. All the religions actually do point out to the Lord, do show the way to the Lord. But the problem begins when people do not really follow the essence of the religion. They just get caught up with the rituals. Then the problem begins. And in today's world, practically all the religions are just caught up with some rituals. What did I say? I'm telling you time and time again, all the religions do show the way to the Lord, do take to the Lord, provided it is followed the way it is taught by the preceptor. Well, if when one practices properly, then sure he goes back to God. At least make some progress towards God. Yes. Yeah, sure. No, go ahead.
By accepting God, by taking the oath, just like love, straight to it, by accepting every word of the Bible and then the love of God,
Right. Naturally, yeah, naturally. Yeah, sure, I don't deny that. Yeah, one. That's what I was saying, that one has to practice the process. The process has been given, right? But the onus is on the individual, how earnestly he is going to practice the process, right? Naturally. Oh yeah. And to make another point into, you know, over your statement there, as a matter of fact, you see, the more you approach towards God, the more you realize how impossible it is to come close to Him. it is a matter of realization. You see, like a person who is really situated on the spiritual platform, he will not claim that he got God, or he, you know, like on the other hand, he becomes more humble and says that how much he can get Him. And now to rationalize it or to give a reasonable, you know, analysis why it happened, we can simply say that, you see, we are minute, right? And the Lord is absolute. So I thank you all for coming to this program tonight.